Good morning. I'd like to call the February 20th Pension Committee meeting to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the November 21st, 2019 minutes. Previous this meeting, they had been emailed to you. Is there any questions or comments about these minutes?
No.
Okay, hearing none, they will stand approved. The next two items on the agenda are the review of the 2019 changes and the performance reports of the pension OPEB funds. We have Pat Wing here from Marquette Associates to go over both those items. Pat and I had discussed prior to the meeting. We're going to take those two out of order. We're going to do the performance reports first because that goes with the quarter as of December 31st, and then the changes pretty much took effect after that. So it makes more sense to do it in that order. So I'm going to turn it over to Pat Wing.
All right, well, good morning, everyone. Nice to see you again. Obviously filling in for Michael today. He's in warmer weather down in Florida, but good to see you. But as Gina mentioned, we have the book that I handed out is the quarterly performance report. And then in the back of the book, where we'll get to later, is an overview of the asset allocation and the portfolio changes that were made towards the end of the quarter and into the new year. So with all that said, I think today's meeting is going to be a little different than normal just because of the change in the relationship between the county and Marquette. The quarterly returns pretty much for everything up until the last week were the previous investment managers in the fund. So we'll still talk about that. We'll talk about the quarterly performance, the annual performance, but then we'll spend a little bit of time really within the market environment, providing some context for how the pension fund and the OPEB fund performed the way it did, but also to give you some context or a little bit of how we're thinking about the economy and capital markets, particularly equities, and how that drove some of the changes that we made towards the end of the year. So with all that said, if you want to flip behind your book, behind Exhibit 2, skip over Exhibit 1, that's just an update on Marquette as a firm as a whole, and nothing too interesting going on there. Just want to say business as usual. So behind Exhibit 2, you'll find your market environment. And just broadly, before we hop into the quarter and the year as a whole, I want to provide it some broader context. So for 2019, what we really saw was a complete polar opposite of 2018. In 2018, we had a pretty strong economy, pretty strong corporate earnings growth, both of those largely on the back of the tax legislation that was enacted at the end of 2017. But then on the flip side of that, we had some pretty poor capital markets returns, particularly in the fourth quarter of 2018. And what drove that, even though the economy was strong and corporate earnings were strong, was that the narrative that most investors seem to be focused on these days is, what is the Fed going to do? How are they going to change policy? And about 15 months ago in late 2018, the Fed had been raising interest rates. They seemed set on the course to continue to raise rates in 2019, and investors really became concerned that they were going to continue to really step or pump on the brakes of the economy at a time when most thought it was poised to slow. So in late 2018, the Fed had talked about continuing to raise rates. In 2019, continuing to contract their balance sheet, which is another part of their toolkit to change policy. And that drove a lot of the downdraft that we saw at the end of 2018. Now, as you switch gears into 2019, then almost flipped the script across the board. We had a slowing economy. We had little to no corporate earnings growth. But as we'll see shortly, from a capital markets perspective, we had really strong returns among equity markets in particular. And again, that was driven by a change in Fed policy. They came into the beginning of the year, pretty much did a 180, backed off all of the planned interest rate increases that they had previously said they were going to make, actually ended up cutting interest rates three times throughout the years and began expanding their balance sheet again. And really that shift, their 180 from the Fed, caused investor sentiment to turn on a dime. So we saw really strong gains in equity markets in the first quarter. The second and third quarters were a little bit more subdued, but then again in the fourth quarter, we saw really strong returns. So this Fed narrative of what they're going to do, how they're going to change policy, has really been the key driver among markets. So with all that said for context, if we look at page one in the market environment where you see the U.S. economy, focus on the top chart there where we're showing real GDP growth or economic growth within the U.S. If you look at that chart, those blue bars are the quarterly numbers, and there's a lot of volatility or noise around those numbers. So we tend to focus on that orange line, which is the year-over-year change in economic growth. We feel it's a little bit more indicative of the underlying trend in the economy. And you can see that line really sort of tail off at mid to late 2018. So economic growth did slow in 2019. A couple things playing a role there. Number one, the tax legislation that we saw at the end of 2017 provided the biggest bang for its buck, if you will, in 2018, and the impact of those changes faded over time. And the second big thing was really business investment. What we saw was pretty soft business investment throughout the year, given some policy uncertainty, particularly as it related to trade. You know, what was going to happen with China? Number one, were we going to get a trade deal? And number two, what was that trade deal going to look like? So given that uncertainty, we saw some pretty soft business investment, and that again was another key headwind for the economy. So that's an overview of, you know, what's happened more recently. But as we think about how things may unfold going forward, as we head through 2020, we begin to explore that further at the bottom of page one and then the subsequent pages in the market environment. So if you look at the bottom of page one, what we're showing here is the change in leading economic indicators within the U.S. So this is a widely followed report by most market participants. And you can see all the way to the right there, the end of that blue line at the bottom chart, there's been no change in leading economic indicators this year, and it really peaked probably about that mid-2018 point when the economy peaked as well. So it really foreshadowed the slowing economic growth that we saw in 2019. But interestingly, if you look back over the past 10 years in that same chart, there's been two other periods where we've seen a slowdown in these leading economic indicators, all the way back in 2012 and then again around 2016. And there are some pretty good similarities between what happened then and the dynamics that we're seeing unfolding right now. And you can see in those earlier periods, the leading economic indicators softened pretty notably, but didn't sort of fall off the precipice. They really rebounded subsequently. So what was going on then, again, is pretty similar to what's going on right now. And if you look at the top chart on page two, what we're taking a look at is the manufacturing sector in the economy is the blue line, and in the orange line is the non-manufacturing or services sector. So these are two surveys of those respective sectors. Any number above 50 is generally indicative of expansion in that respective sector, and below 50 indicative of contraction. So if you look all the way to the right there, more recently, we've seen manufacturing, that blue line, dip pretty notably below 50. So manufacturing has really borne the brunt of the slowdown we've seen recently, where services in the orange line has dipped a bit, but has remained pretty relatively resilient. Now, if you go back to those two earlier periods that I mentioned a second ago in 2015 and 2012, again, it was a similar type of dynamic where manufacturing really bore the brunt of the slowdown and services remained relatively resilient. So that's a key question that we're monitoring right now. And I would note that we put this analysis together prior to the release of the most recent data, and we have seen an uptick in manufacturing recently. There was a report in December where it was around 47, in January that came out at 51, so really indicative of that manufacturing sector expanding again in January. So we're hopeful, or we believe going forward, that we're going to see a similar dynamic where services is going to remain pretty resilient and manufacturing is going to converge back to services to the upside. So as we think about that going forward, if that does unfold, and I'll talk a little bit in a minute about the impact of the coronavirus out in China and the impact elsewhere, is that we could see continued slow and sluggish growth within the U.S., but there are signs that an inflection point could lie ahead, perhaps later in Q2 or in the beginning of the second half of the year. So if you skip ahead to page three, we take a look outside the U.S. The top chart there, it's a similar dynamic though, where the orange lines are leading indicators and then the blue lines are more indicative of underlying growth. So the top chart, we take a look at Europe. That orange line there is a measure of economic sentiment within Europe, really measuring future expectations for economic growth. And you can see over the past few months, we've seen a big jump in economic sentiment within Europe, you know, at the highest level in a couple of years. And at least historically, the blue line there, which is indicative of a good measure of the overall European economy, has generally tracked that with a little bit of a lag. So again, we think sluggish growth could continue in the U.S., outside the U.S., but if these leading indicators, if we can use history as a guide, we should see an uptick in European growth. And then on the bottom, we look at China. Within China, the leading indicator we look at, again, is that orange line. What it's called is the China credit impulse. It's really a fancy way of saying whether credit growth is growing in China or whether it's decelerating. And you can see there's a big pickup there, at least over the last year, in that orange line of credit growth. And historically, the manufacturing sector line in blue has tended to follow credit growth within China. So again, if history is any guide, we should expect to see a pickup in the Chinese economy as well. Now, taking a step back, all that said, again, this doesn't take into account the coronavirus that we've seen outside the U.S. So we've seen a lot of impact, not just in China, but globally. Within China, as I'm sure you all have seen, we've seen pretty much certain cities shut down. We've seen production pretty much grind to a halt. You know, the Chinese citizens in many of the provinces out there are under quarantine, so they can't make purchases of things that they likely plan to do, and even has other effects outside of China. So there's places, say in Europe or even in the US, that aren't getting the parts that China supplies to them in order to meet their production demands right now. So this coronavirus, again, I think is an issue obviously in the short term, but I think fits with the theme that growth is going to continue to be sluggish in the first half of the year. This would just further reinforce that point, but assuming the virus is gotten under control, say within the next 2 or 3 months, all of that lost production, all of the lost consumption or purchases within the Chinese economy, that's what's called pent-up demand. So it's lost early on, but then later in the year should come to fruition. So we think, again, in the second half of the year, we could be looking at an inflection point in the U.S. and the global economy. Now, while that's important, as we shift gears to page 4, and you look at the bottom chart below there, we're showing asset class returns across the board. So the first 3 rows are equity market returns. You see U.S., international developed equities, and emerging market equities. For the 4th quarter, those are the lighter gray bars. You can see very strong returns. The U.S. and international developed markets up between 8 and 9%. Emerging markets up 12%. We look below emerging markets and U.S. bonds. Those are high-quality bonds, the types of bonds that Wilmington Trust invests in on behalf of the pension and the OPEB funds. They were flat for the quarter, but for the year, they were up 9%. So really strong gains across traditional assets that comprise a lot of the assets for the respective pension and OPEB funds. So when I said a second ago, we're really going to need to see that inflection point. Last year, we saw slowing growth. We saw little to no growth in corporate earnings, but massive gains in equity markets. So equity markets right now, we would argue, are sort of pricing in that inflection point, or pricing in a pickup in economic growth, a pickup in corporate earnings growth. And to the extent that we don't see that, or it doesn't come to fruition, we could be in line for perhaps about a volatility or a correction as the year progresses. So with that in mind, I'll talk a little bit later on how we restructured the respective funds from an equity markets perspective with that context of the possibility of those sorts of things unfolding. So when you look at this page, you see equity, strong equity returns, strong fixed income returns. So when you put the pieces together, as we'll see in just a minute, for the pension and the OPEB funds, they had strong absolute returns. The OPEB was up 20% for last year. The pension was well short of that because, as you all well know, the state had a tough year last year. So the pension was up, as we'll see, about 17.5%, and that difference between the two funds really came from the state underperforming its respective benchmark. So if you skip ahead, I'll wrap up here on page 5 before we jump into the details of the respective funds. One of the other themes that we've been seeing going on within, and we're focused on the U.S. equity market here, we always like to take a deep dive under the hood because it comprises a lot of the underlying investments within the pension and OPEB funds and really all U.S.-based institutional investors. And if I'm going to focus on those top two charts here, what we've seen is a pretty narrow market. And when I say narrow market, I mean only a handful of areas or a handful of stocks have driven a disproportionate amount of the gains. So I'll illustrate that by these graphs and then talk about why that's important. So in that first top left-hand chart there, you see what we're showing is the contribution to index returns, three indices, which you see at the bottom of that chart horizontally, the Russell 1000, that's a large cap index, the Russell mid cap index, and then the Russell 2000, a small cap index, all within the US. So these four industry groups have driven about half of the gains in December in the fourth quarter for the Russell 1000 large cap. It was a little bit less pronounced in mid cap, but then again, half of the gains in small caps. And when I say a narrow market, they're driven by just four industry groups, but there's 24 industry groups in total. So if we quantify that, what I'm saying is 16% of all industry groups drove about half the gains for those respective indices. Again, getting back to that disproportionate or narrow market. And of those industry groups, we footnote them below, but it was areas like semiconductors or areas like biotech and life sciences, really the latter more speculative areas of the market. So gains were disproportionate, and those areas that drove the gains tend to have been more speculative. If you look at the top right, we're showing a similar type of analysis, but it's for the S&P 500, and it's for the year as a whole for 2019. So what we're showing here is these five stocks, what their contribution on a percent basis was to the return. So if you add those five stocks together, they accounted for more than a quarter of the S&P 500 return. So on the flip side of that, that means 1% accounted for that. So the other 495 stocks, the remaining 99% accounted for less than 3/4 of the return. So a handful of stocks, and you can see those names there in that axis, names like Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, JP Morgan's a little bit of an outlier within this group, and then Amazon, really large cap growth, sort of high-flying tech names have been driving the market. So speculative areas and high growth names have been driving the market. And why that's important from the fund's perspective is the pension and an OPEB fund from the U.S. equity was mostly indexed, but they had some global equity investments. So global equities can invest in international and domestic stocks. But the fact that the domestic portion of their benchmark was so concentrated with regard to how returns were driven, it was a really challenging environment for active managers to keep pace when only a handful of names or a handful of areas are driving the market, because those active managers tend to be more diversified, hold much more names, aren't going to hold, say, 15, 20, 25% of their respective portfolios in just a handful of stocks. So with all that said, let me pause for a quick second before I shift gears and get into the returns for the respective funds. Good. Good? Okay. So if you flip behind the next exhibit, we'll walk through the pension, really again focusing at a high level of returns and digging below those returns, really explaining the differences between the pension fund returns and the policy index. So if you look at page 1, the observations at the top of the page, at the end of the year, the pension had a market value just a shade under $124 million. In the fourth quarter, the fund had an investment gain of about $6 million and the return of 5% versus 6% for the policy index. So about a percentage point behind, the state pool accounted for about 75 to 80% of that difference. And then if you shift gears and look below into 2019, you can see an investment gain of $18 million for the year, a return of 17.3%. versus 21% for the policy index, so about 3.5 percentage points, and again, a similar type of headwind from the state pool where it accounted for about 75% of that underperformance. If you look below that, speaking of the state pool, that liquidation occurred at the end of the year. I think it was around December 18th, December 19th. And then those proceeds came into Wilmington Trust, the custodial bank, the day after. And then when that came in, we transitioned the existing investments from where they were to our, what's labeled here, OCIO lineup, essentially our best ideas portfolio. And we have a transition overview, which we'll walk through shortly. And then looking ahead, you can see below, and these, it says looking ahead because this is a 12/31 report, but these things already happened. They happened at the first of the year. So the investment in Clarion Lion Properties Fund real estate was made. It says 1/1. Obviously, that was not a business day, so the wire went out January 2nd. And then below that, that investment policy statement addendum that was signed in December was also effective in the beginning of the year. And since real estate became a part of the portfolio in the beginning of the year, the allocations are reasonably in line with that policy right now, well within the ranges as set by that policy. So if you look at page 2, more of a quantitative illustration of these numbers, I really want to focus on the one-year numbers here, particularly in these top two charts, or the top table in the middle chart. So you can see the 1 year, the fund began at about $100.8 million after a tough 2018. There was a contribution in the middle of the year to the pension fund, and we have that coupled with the investment change, the line right above that dark blue at the bottom of $18 million, the fund grew by about $23 million during the year. So that's how you get to the 123.8 that I mentioned a minute ago. When you look at the returns, again, focusing on that 1 year, you see the total fund there up 17.3%. The policy index in orange up at 21. We already talked about that as far as what caused that underperformance. Again, 75-80% of that was the state pool. But importantly, even though your fiscal year is June 30th, when you think about 2018 and 2019 in combination in 2018, the fund was down about 2.7%, so behind that assumed rate of return of about 9.7, because the assumed rate of return is 7. But this year, the fund was up 17.3, so a bit more than 10% above the assumed rate of return. So when you put the pieces together, when you got your actuarial report, last year you saw the hit, some of the hit from 2018 built into that, built into the funded ratio. But since we'd have strong gains in the back half of 2019 and into early 2020, hopefully when the next valuation report comes out, it's going to reflect that increased funded ratio, increased improvement of the overall health of the fund, given the strong gains that we saw in the back half of this year, and importantly in the beginning part of this year. The last thing I want to mention on this page is at the bottom. When you look at the bottom table, it says asset allocation versus target. So these are all the respective asset classes within the fund to the left. The current allocations as of the end of the year, and you see your policy allocations. And then all the way to the right, it's essentially saying, are your allocations within the range as set forth by the investment policy statement? And it says, yes, 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 no. So why does it say no? So again, this is a snapshot at the end of the year. We had raised cash that was sitting in cash that then was subsequently wired to the new real estate manager on January 2nd. So as of 12/31, it was outside because that cash was waiting to be wired. But now on January 2nd and to this day, it's back within the policy allocations.
And it went to Clarion.
That's correct. So we skip ahead to pages 3 and 4 are more granular type data that I'm going to walk through under the transition review. You focus on, skip ahead to page 8, and I think this will be instructive to some of the comments I made earlier, specifically the bottom part of this page where we're showing the state Delaware investment pool returns. This is as of November. They did not give us a partial return prior to the liquidation, but you can see there, quarter to date, just October and November, they were percent behind the benchmark. I think with the preliminary calculations we did, you could pretty much extrapolate that for December. So for the quarter, they were behind by about 1.5%. So again, when we think about the fund being a percentage point behind the policy index and the state pool comprising 40 or so percent of the fund, it explains the vast majority of that underperformance. And then year-to-date as well, you could see 6 percentage points behind. If you tack on December to that, about 6.5%. And again, if you take around 40% of that, that's 3-ish percentage points. So again, explains the differences between how the pension did versus the policy index. And then you see the longer-term returns there as well, where we've seen fairly consistent underperformance, but obviously not telling you anything you don't already know. And these numbers, or the impact of the state, are going to be really apparent when I shift gears and talk about the OPEB in a second, because the OPEB obviously didn't have an allocation to the state pool. So with all that said, before I shift gears to the OPEB, is there anything else or any other comments or questions as it relates to the pension fund?
No, we're good. Thank you.
So if you hop behind Exhibit 4, start to look at the OPEB plan, and this is the same exhibits, obviously, for the different fund, but we'll hit the same pages. And again, I think the impact of the state will be more easily drawn out by looking at these numbers. So if we look at the observations at the beginning of that page, you see a market value of about $49 million at the end of the year. In the fourth quarter, the fund had an investment gain of $2.6 million, return of 5.6 versus 6% for the policy index. So again, you can see 5.6 for the OPEB versus 5 for the pension. So the impact from the state there. And then similarly for 2019, the fund gained a little north of $8 million with a return of 20% versus 20.6% for the policy index. So again, you can see the difference, 20% for the OPEB versus 17.3 for the pension. And again, that slight underperformance, that goes back to two things. Number one, on the fixed income side, Wilmington Trust was slightly behind their benchmark for the year. And number two, for the active managers in the fund, they were slightly behind their benchmark. Those global managers that invest in both domestic and international stocks, given that challenging environment that I outlined a few minutes ago of the U.S. market really being only driven by a handful of names. That second main bullet point you see there, the fund transitioned to the OCIO lineup, pretty much the same as the pension, actually a day before, because we weren't waiting for liquidation funds from the state pool. And then looking ahead, the allocation to Clarion Lion Properties Fund, that 5% real estate, happened in the beginning of January, and then the new investment policy statement went into effect January 1st, 2020. On page 2, again, similar information, but for the OPEB, if you look at the summary of cash flows, up top, again, focusing on that one-year period, we began the year with about $41 million in the OPEB, and, you know, minimal cash flows, but an investment gain of about $8.2 million caused that OPEB fund to jump from $41 million to $49.2 million by the end of the year. If you look at the returns in the middle of the page, that graphic, again, focusing on that 1 year and just echoing the comments I made a second ago about the pension versus the assumed rate of return. In 2018, the OPEB was down by about 4.9%, so behind the assumed rate of return by about 11.9%. But you can see the return for this year, 20%, so 13% ahead. So again, just harkening back to that idea that the lost ground that not just the county, but all institutional investors bore, given the poor results of 2018, was recouped and then some in the back half of 2019. And again, so far we've seen a decent start to this year. January was actually pretty flat, but February has actually seen quite strong returns. Still on page 2 at the bottom, you see the asset allocation policy again versus the targets. And again, all the way to the right, there are things within the range, and at the bottom it says no. And again, similar to the pension, that's because we needed to raise cash towards the end of the year, and the Clarion Lion Properties Fund, the real estate investment, those funds were wired on January 2nd. So as we stand here today and all the way back to January 2nd, the asset allocation was in line with policy. So we skip ahead to page 7. Again, the pages in between are more granular look at some of the data, which I'll talk about during the transition review. I just wanted to mention a couple of things here. So on page 7, what we're showing here is at the top, it's the total equity composite. So essentially, that's a weighted average of your equity manager returns. Those returns are reflective of the legacy managers within the funds. Again, we made the transition in the back half of December 2019 or last December. So a lot of the managers you see on this page are newer. So there is, these are the returns for those respective funds over their lifetimes. There's not, they're not actually the returns that the OPEB fund actually experienced, but we like to include them for context. A couple of the managers we did not replace. If you work your way down the page there, you see Dodge & Cox. Maybe about one, two, three, six of those lighter gray lines down the page. Dodge & Cox, another one of those global equity managers, was up about 11% for the quarter. They benefited from a couple of tailwinds. They were up. They had an overweight to emerging markets, which, as I showed a few minutes ago, emerging markets outperformed developed markets by about 4 percentage points. So that was a tailwind for them. And they also had pretty good stock selection during the quarter, so they had a solid quarter. On the flip side, below that, you see MFS Low Volatility Global Equity. So this is a fund that was in the pension and also in the OPEB. For the OPEB, you could see the return, they were up about 5% below the broad equity market of about 9%. So they're a lower volatility, more conservative manager. So in a quarter where things are up 9%, we would expect them to underperform. That's a little more or a little larger underperformance than we would typically see, but you have the headwind of a very strong market coupled with those dynamics going on within the U.S. equity market that I talked about a second ago. So they were facing a couple of key headwinds during the quarter. And then if you work your way all the way below the page there, the fixed income composite, that was also a little bit of a headwind where you have Wilmington Trust up 0.2% for the quarter behind their benchmark by 20 basis points. And then again for the year, they were up 6.4% behind their benchmark by about 0.5%. So with all that said, let me pause for a second. I'm planning to shift gears now to talk about January performance update and use that in conjunction with an overview of the transition.
Pat, yeah. We have the same investments in both funds now, right?
Fairly close. It's very close. There are some subtle differences because when we, and I'll outline these, when we make recommendations as a, you know, in our previous agreement, they were, you know, our best ideas or two or three best ideas, and the committee would make that selection. And one of the managers in the pension fund, who's a Schroders, who we like both in the global and international space. So we kept them in global for the pension, but in the OPEB, we're using them in the international side because it's the same team and same process. So we felt like it's a good complement. And one of the things we do when we make the transition is we want to be cognizant of costs, right? You know, because when you do the transition, you know, the funds would have to bear those costs. So if it's something where, hey, we like this manager, it's one of our best ideas, it's in the global space here, well, let's keep that there. And then on the international side, let's not double down on Schroders, but let's use another one of our best ideas in that area. So there are some subtle differences, but they mirror each other pretty closely. Okay.
Pat, you, I'll need a lot of perspective as time goes on. Maybe I'll catch up with the rest of you, but you keep talking about how we have compared to benchmarks, and recognizing our investment policy says you as the manager have a general expectation to meet or exceed. How well have you done in the past?
So as we, our relationship has changed at the end of last year. So previously we were just strictly the consultant. Okay. In a traditional relationship, so we would bring recommendations to the county as it related to asset allocation or as it related to which managers to choose, but we would bring options to the committee and they would choose. So now with the county, with respect to both of these funds, now we are the investment manager, but historically it's all been in that other relationship starting 1/1/20. Now we're acting in the new capacity.
Thank you.
But just for further context, we've been working at in an investment manager in a discretionary approach for more than 10 years with a number of other similar investors. Okay. All right, so if you flip all the way to the back of your book, there's a hardcover back there, and there are a few inserts. The first is the January performance update, so this would be the first month where we're acting in a discretionary capacity. And then there's another insert for the rest of the recipe, as I'm sure you all well know, and then some festivals and fairs going on in Delaware on the back of that, but I won't spend time on that. That's, you can review at your leisure, at your interest. But if you look at this portrait page, the single portrait page, and look at the pension, I'm going to use that in conjunction with this other document, the staple document that's labeled transition review. So I'm going to make some brief comments as it relates to the update, and then we'll walk through the transition review, but that a little bit of a more detailed explanation of the things that I discussed. So right there for the pension and the portfolio update, it says QTD, so that's quarter to date, just January. Obviously, we're still in February. You can see the total fund net return was essentially flat for the month. You know, the dynamics that we saw in January, in the beginning of January, were kind of a continuation of what we saw last year, where those sort of speculative, high-flying tech names were really driving the market until fears of the coronavirus hit. And then when things sold off, we saw more defensive names do better and protect better in that down market when that unfolded at the back half of January. But if you work your way down the page, I'll start to flesh out some of the changes we made. So if you look under the third brown line where it says U.S. equity composite, so that's the weighted average of underlying U.S. equity managers. So previously for the pension and the OPEB, all of U.S. equities were indexed. For the pension, they were indexed where the committee had the decisions. For the state pool, there was a lot of active management in there, but for what the committee had control over, it was largely indexed. We've kept it to be largely indexed. U.S. equities are one of the most efficient asset classes. It's essentially meaning it's tough for active managers to outperform in the U.S. equity space compared to global equities, compared to international equities. But the changes we've made, if you work your way down specifically to that second lighter gray line where you see American Funds, Washington Mutual, and then below that Vanguard Dividend Growth, is we're using mostly index, but we are using two large cap active managers. And those managers over the long term, we believe, if history is any guide, are going to be more defensive. So why did we incorporate them? Number one, because of some of the concerns we have right now over the economy. You know, we see an inflection point, but if we don't see that inflection point unfold, we think again we could be in about or in store for maybe some volatility or a correction, and we would expect those managers to outperform in that environment. If you look below that, below U.S. equity, the next darker brown line there where it says global equity composite, the changes that were made here, so two of these managers, MFS in the middle and then Schroders, were existing managers that were previously being used. So we did two things here. Number one, we added Dodge & Cox there, which is a large cap value manager. And we increased the allocation to global equity. So previously, the pension, you know, again, ignoring the state pool, had about a 6% allocation to active global equity managers. Right now, it's upwards of about 14%. So if you think about where you're taking tilts or active risk within the portfolio, previously, the investments outside the state pool were largely indexed because the state was taking a lot of active risk. So we need to think about how all the pieces fit together. Now that the state is gone, where do we decide to take active risks or really use active managers is in the global equity space. And it's something that we've talked about with the committee over a number of years. Historically, we found that global equity managers have the highest probability of outperforming. They can invest in the U.S., they can invest internationally, emerging markets, really go where they see the best opportunities, and that's where our clients have had the most success or have seen the biggest added value over time. So we've added a manager there and we've increased that allocation. If you look in the non-U.S. equity space below that, just echoing my comments earlier, here we're what we did was trim an index fund that was in place there. It was previously just an index fund because, again, the state had a lot of active managers. But we've also added the manager, you see there, Hartford International Opportunities Fund. That is a fund that's sub-advised by Wellington Management, a very well-respected investment management firm out of Boston. They sub-advise that for Hartford. And going back to my earlier comment, that's going to be one of the key differences between the pension and the OPEB, whereas in the pension, we're using Schroders, again, in that global equity space because they were a legacy manager there. But usually we use them in the international space as well. We don't want to double down on there, so we use Hartford, sub-advised by Wellington, another one of our best ideas in that space. The other key changes, if you look within fixed income, you'll notice a few new names there. So you see Wilmington Trust. They have been managing the fixed income assets for quite a long time, but below that you see a Fidelity Intermediate Treasury Bond Index Fund and a couple of managers that are active but focusing more on credit areas, things like investment-grade corporate bonds, high-yield bonds, mortgage-backed securities, commercial mortgage-backed securities. And the reason we introduced new managers in this space, so the state had about 40% of the pool, but it wasn't all equities. Right, about 40% of that 40% wasn't fixed income. So what we didn't want to do was give all the money to Wilmington Trust and really have all of the fixed income eggs in Wilmington Trust's basket, if you will. So that influx there of, call it $16+ million, we implemented, or using these three additional managers instead of having Wilmington Trust manage $36 million in isolation, we wanted to increase that diversification, and that lineup there is consistent with our best ideas of how to structure fixed income, where we're using intermediate treasury bonds. We feel like they're a staple of all institutional portfolios. You know, when the metaphorical stuff hits the fan, treasuries tend to do well, and this is a passive approach. So no active manager can really outperform in the treasury space. They're very efficient, very liquid. So basically, we want to own it, but we don't want to pay anybody to do it. So that's an index fund that just has an expense ratio of just 3 basis points. So it's a very cheap way to get exposure to treasuries. And then we complement that allocation using those two active managers of BlackRock and Lord Abbott. Again, more on the short-term end of the spectrum. They're more active managers, again, focusing more on investment-grade corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, commercial mortgage-backed securities, high-yield debt, things of that nature. If you flip to the next page, or not to the next page, the other side, you'll see the return for the OPEB down about 20 basis points for the month. It's more or less rounding. It was in line with the pension, but rounded to 20, where the pension rounded to 10. Slightly below that policy index that was down 10 basis points. So many similarities on this page. If you look at the US equity composite, that's the same structure as we implemented on the pension for those reasons I outlined a second ago. If you look at the global equity page, it's a little different in the sense of the names that are being used. So Dodge & Cox, same name, MFS, same name. That Virtus von Tobel is a different name. So right now, the OPEB did not have an allocation to Schroders. And as I mentioned before, we tend to use them on the international side, but we like them on the global side too. So since they were doing global in the pension, we kept them here, kept them there, and changed it on the international side. Here, we're using von Tobel, who's the sub-advisor for this Virtus fund, and then we're using Schroders. Again, same team and same process, just focusing on the international side in the non-US equity composite. The last thing I'll mention on this page that's different under fixed income, right now we have Wilmington Trust just managing the fixed income in isolation. So when we had the influx of money coming from the state, we didn't give it to them. We diversified that within those other managers. Right now, Wilmington Trust continues to be that manager of all the fixed income within the OPEB, but like the rest of the portfolio, that's something, you know, certainly under consideration as we move forward. Questions or comments about that? I have this transition book that I wanted to run through. I think is more qualitative, certainly more digestible, but certainly reflective of many of the comments that I've already made.
Are you planning any changes to the current investments here now?
To the current investments? No. No, so what we do is, we're not planning any changes. Obviously, we just moved this. It's, you know, 2 months, if that at all. So we're not planning any changes. It's something where we meet weekly to review the allocations, to talk about the underlying managers, and to see if any changes are warranted. And when we met earlier this week, we decided that there were no changes that were warranted. I think as we move forward, and not to scoop the later conversation, you know, perhaps later in the year we could talk about maybe different ideas for other asset classes to increase the diversification of the respective funds. But as far as the implementation itself, we see it in a good position right now. But we review it regularly every week. On Monday we meet to look at all the clients where we manage the assets on a discretionary basis. Look at the allocations. Do we need to raise cash? Do we need to rebalance? Or should we make any manager changes?
Pat, refresh my memory. How often do you guys rebalance on this?
Rebalance? Usually around when either equities or fixed income are have deviated from their target by 2 to 2.5%.
2 to 2.5%.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I could walk through this last deck fairly quickly. Again, I think it's just echoing some of the comments I've already made on the overview. You know, we talked about these things when the agreement went into place. You know, we were fortunate enough to get some authorization later signed, because it wasn't just as easy as, you know, we can't tell these guys we're, you know, we have the authority now. We have authorization letters that need to go to the bank, need to go to the investment managers, and we got those executed and taken care of pretty quickly, so we were able to implement those changes before year end. If you look on page 3 there of that deck, a lot going on this page, but it just gives you an idea of all that went into the transition for the pension, particularly with the liquidation of the state pool. It talks about the underlying investments, or shows you the previous investments, what was liquidated and how much in that rebalancing middle column. Obviously, red numbers are money moving out, and then the black numbers are money moving in, and you can see the allocations and the new targets there. I'm not going to walk through that. It's just something that I wanted to show you, you know, everything behind the scenes. If you flip to the next page, this is an overview. So you saw essentially the mechanics of what took place at the end of December, and here's an overview of the changes. And I think I kind of walked through most of this already, talked about the U.S., how it's still mostly indexed because it's efficient, but we're more defensive, particularly among large caps, given those concerns about the economy and given concerns about what we've seen for the stocks that have outperformed, right? You know, historically, when you have an area like information technology that tends to do the best in a bull market, it tends to get hit the hardest in the downturn. So we're cognizant of that. And those two large cap managers that we've implemented are going to have underweights to those areas. So they're going to participate or capture most of the upside if the market continues to run along as it has. But in any subsequent downturn, we would expect them to protect on the downside. As far as the global and international, and really as you walk through these bullet points here, I had already mentioned them. As far as the changes within the global, increasing the allocation to existing managers and increasing the allocation to global as a whole. International, I touched on real estate. Again, that was added in the beginning of the year. And then the fixed income itself, at least for the pension, again, adding the managers for diversification, not having all of the money go to Wilmington Trust. You flip to page 5, there's an overview of the OPEB transition, again showing you just the mechanics behind everything, you know, showing you all the legacy managers there, their respective allocations. You see the rebalancing in the middle of the page. Again, if it's red, it means money was pulled, and if it's black, it means money went there. Their allocations, and then the targets to the right. So again, this is everything that went on behind the scenes in late December to reposition, to transition the portfolio to our best ideas. And then just to wrap up on page 6, it's an overview of those changes. So this will obviously mirror much of the language that you saw 2 pages earlier as it relates to the U.S., as it relates to global, as it relates to international. But also you'll notice some of the changes there. where within the global space, one of the changes I didn't mention earlier, we had an allocation to Artisan Global Opportunities, and so a global growth manager that was just within the OPEB. We decided to replace them with that Virtus Fontobel Fund that is also a global growth manager, but it's a more defensive approach where we would expect over the long term then to have similar type returns as Artisan, but do so in a more conservative or a less volatile pattern to get there over that long-term time horizon. And then you can see real estate was added, and there's no mention of fixed income here because on the OPEB, Wilmington Trust was managing the money. There was no additional money coming from other fixed income managers to diversify those fixed income assets. So as of right now, Wilmington Trust continues to manage all the fixed income money for the OPEB as well. So let me pause.
I think these reports are very good. I think it shows where you've made changes since not only the transition, but where you made changes within the funds.
And right.
I think that's, I don't know, will you be able to provide that in the future?
Yeah, I get something like that every week. So when they're looking at them to see if we're out of the 2% or 2.5%, he'll email them to me weekly. I can forward them to you so you can see where everything stands on a weekly basis.
Is it possible just to do this?
That's all it is. Is that one?
No, it's that exact page.
It's that exact page?
Yeah.
It's okay. That page I get every week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a problem.
Yeah, our committee reviews it at the beginning of the week, and then once we decide to keep things as is or make changes, we vote on it, and then once those changes are done, we mail them out to our respective clients.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I might just have you add the committee to it.
Yeah, cut out. You'll be happy to add. And if you just want to give me a list.
I'll email everybody the email address. And
okay.
I have a question about costs. I know we moved a lot from index to active managers, and we were somewhere under 30 basis points before. Do you have any idea where we are now that we've moved?
Yeah, that page is, those pages are in the fund. Apologies, I skipped over that. Let me see. So if you go behind Exhibit 3 for the pension, on page 9, and we have the page for the OPEB as well.
So this is after the transition?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And then there's a similar page if you look in the OPEB plan. It's page 8 for the OPEB, similar breakdown of fees as well. And that's something, I apologize for skipping over that. But that's something that we put in, as you know, in every single performance report as far as the fees for the underlying investment managers.
How do you feel about you're moving a lot of assets away from Wilmington Trust to other bond managers? Do you think yield and performance will improve? It's probably a rhetorical question, but half the assets being the U.S. Treasuries within their fund, the way I see it here, yielding 2%. What do you expect from that going forward?
As far as the managers being used or how the fixed income is invested?
A couple managers and peers, right?
Right. Yeah, so I think... So we didn't pull money from Wilmington Trust to move it to those managers. That was money from coming from the state. There was money that came from Wilmington Trust to fund real estate. So when we made the policy changes, using we loosely here, when the policy changes were made, how the 5% allocation was sourced was from fixed income. So any money you see coming out of Wilmington Trust was used to source the real estate investment. Now, to the second part of the question about the underlying investments of the fixed income, that new structure we've implemented on the pension, so not giving money all to Wilmington Trust, but implementing that other structure, what essentially that is kind of a barbell approach, where we have the intermediate treasuries, low cost on the one side, and then those active short-term credit managers on the other side. And when we put those pieces together, at least historically, we found that we can out-yield the benchmark by maybe 30 or 40 basis points. But given you have that allocation to intermediate treasury bonds, which really provide the protection and the insurance for the portfolio, you have a similar type of risk characteristics of the benchmark. So right now, how the policy is constructed, the policy is using an intermediate government credit index, which is a pretty conservative type measure. So within the constraints of the policy, we feel that that addition, at least, to Wilmington Trust should increase the yield of fixed income without necessarily adding an additional risk to the fixed income.
The Wilmington Trust is all intermediate, is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay.
They're for the pension and the OPEB, they're running an intermediate government credit portfolio. That's one of the other reasons we added those other managers, because they just have treasuries and corporates. But then those other managers on the short term, they provide different type of exposures, like a little bit of high yield, securitized assets where you're not getting like mortgage-backed securities, commercial mortgage-backed securities, things like that. So getting exposure to some other parts of the fixed income market that we're not getting through Wilmington Trust.
They're all short. And they're short.
The active short ones. Yes, they're short duration. That's correct.
Your next page after costs, which is page 9, I guess this is the I'm in exhibit 4, which is OPIB.
Yes.
We've got 10,000 equity holdings. Is that typical?
When you have a lot of indexing? Yeah, so that's mainly coming through the Vanguard Total Stock Market Index. So you have, you know, 3,000-5,000 holdings in there. And then the passive, the Vanguard Total International Index, there's 6,000 holdings there. So I would caution you against it. It looks like a ton of holdings, but you know, when we're trying to keep costs down, we want cheap exposure to those asset classes. And then the active managers that we're using are much more concentrated, like 50, 60, 70 holdings. So a lot of those holdings, the allocation, particularly on for smaller companies, is de minimis, but you're getting that through the index
fund. $1,000 or something, probably.
Yeah, yeah, but you're getting that through the index funds. Yeah.
On the fees, I know, are your fees aren't in the...
No, this does not include our fees. These are the underlying fees, but I don't know for certain, but I think that's something that we could probably add if the committee would like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
How much is that again? I forgot.
Oh, Gina, I got to rely on you for that.
That's fine. It's now that we've added the additional, it's 14 basis points for the first 100 million and 9 basis points thereafter.
So on $150 million.
Yeah, it was 4 basis points for this extra consulting plus that
right.
They call it.
An extra 4 basis points.
Four was added, okay. But in total it's 14 and
so,
9.
So that probably comes out to about 11, if I'm doing the math, or 11 or 12, when you weight them together.
You're putting OPEB and pension together.
I'm putting it together. Right. They're together.
Yeah, so the assets are aggregated. So
175 million or something like that.
Right. So on for our cost, it's probably around 11 basis points, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Any other questions or comments that I can answer for the committee?
No.
I mean, the only question I have is now next steps going forward. Now that we've done Consulting Plus, we're looking at the investment policy statement we have in place and taking the diversification we had with the state of Delaware. What is the next asset class that we should be looking at? I mean, we just added real estate, but maybe next quarter we look at a new asset class that we could consider.
Sure. So just as a brief history for context, you know, many of our clients, similar to the decision that the committee has made, sort of their first foray into non-traditional assets, and when I say non-traditional, I mean anything outside of equities and fixed income, has been into real estate. That's a good first step. You know, people can digest real estate, right? Most of us own homes. We understand commercial property, so that's usually the first step. Many of our clients, I would say, have an allocation that, say, non-traditional assets, anywhere between 8 to, call it, 15%. Usually the next part of the process or the next asset class we recommend taking a look at is global infrastructure, which is similar to, not in the same ballpark as real estate, but this is a similar type of investment vehicle where it's private, but it's not locked up for 10 or 12 years. There's liquidity quarterly or semi-annually where the investment managers are investing in infrastructure assets in the US and outside the US, things like airports, toll roads, seaports, things of that nature, things that generally are relatively immune to changes in the economic cycle, changing in economic activity, because they provide core services to people. So, you know, if we hit a recession, you know, you're not going to stop going to work and paying tolls going to work. Maybe you drive around a toll or something like that, but that's one of the last things you do. What you give up is your $5 Starbucks every single day. Things like that that are more discretionary for your purchases or how you're going to spend your money. So what we've seen from global infrastructure over time is that it's provided a pretty stable type return that's not on par with equities, but is probably in the neighborhood of 8% or so annually net of fees. So that's the second asset class we typically introduce to our clients, and most of them have adopted that. And when we introduce asset classes, obviously it's not in a vacuum. It's not just, hey, let's do this. It's, okay, well, if we add this, where's the money come from, right? So we're going to draw it from equities, just equities, or we're going to draw it from equities and fixed income. And we talk about that combination and, you know, what that would look like, or what different iterations of asset allocation would look like. What does it do to your return expectations? What does it do to your risk profile? And when I say risk profile, we really focus on the downside risk, like in a worst case scenario. If stuff really goes wrong, that's a big part of our asset allocation studies. So to the extent that the committee would like a discussion on additional opportunities, that would be our recommendation for the first thing, for the next thing to look at.
So you're not talking about the municipal bonds that funds this infrastructure?
No.
You're talking about the companies that build the bridge?
Right, correct. So like these that. Managers would take either full or partial ownership of these companies that provide these services in the U.S. and outside the U.S., so they would have equity stakes in that, and then the revenue from that accrues to investors are the toll money, right? Or leasing charges for airlines to operate at the airport, things of that nature that, again, are less cyclical than just, say, you know, a broad equity market.
Would you recommend that, given the prices in stocks now and the concern about the economy?
Yeah, I think, you know, it all comes back to the conversation around how do you source the investment. So if we were to come back with a recommendation on that, I don't think we would come back and say, let's take this all from fixed income. I know fixed income is a challenging market right now, given interest rates are so low, but at the end of the day, it still plays a very important role in the portfolio. When stuff goes wrong, at the end of the day, fixed income, particularly high quality intermediate bonds, remain a safe haven for investors. So I think it's something where we would look to say, probably not take it all from equities. We would show you that option so you have a frame of reference, but a combination of equities and fixed income I think could make sense, where you would see perhaps an uptick in return expectations, but a similar level of volatility, because infrastructure also provides a good level of diversification to both equities and fixed income. So when you put the pieces together, you can have a higher return expectation without much change in risk or volatility for the portfolio.
That would be great. Okay. Next quarter, do that. And I mean, obviously, like you said, looking at where our assumed rate of return is 7%, are we getting there close with the way we've allocated now and what this would do, and if we took it out of equities. Just like that would be great.
Absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Wing? Okay. If not, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. The last item is additional business. Any members have any item they would like to discuss? Okay. All right.
I've got two questions.
Sure.
If you can give me, I asked Karen a little bit before we started, mm-hmm. the short version of why there's two funds, Okay?
Sure.
And is that typical in government?
Yes.
And secondarily, where are we on funded status?
Sure. So the pension fund is the main fund that pays just the retirement pension wages kind of thing. The OPEB is other pension employee benefits is what it stands for. That is for health insurance, life insurance, the insurance side of things. And yes, it is very typical to be separate. Some people will qualify for only pension and they won't get OPEB, but it is required to be two separate funds. For the most part, if you look at other governments, the OPEB fund isn't funded very well. It's usually a pay-as-you-go kind of scenario for that. Pensions are usually pretty well funded. The last average is 75-80%. We're currently 97.2% funded.
Amen.
In the pension, yes. And that was as of June 30th when the actuary is done. I know if I ran the numbers, we're over 100% now. And then the OPEB, we're doing very well compared to everybody else. We're 84% on the OPEB. So the last couple of years, we've been putting an extra $5 million to $10 million in because the economy is doing well above what the required actuary. So.
State of Delaware is like 2 or 3%.
Correct. Yes. That is correct. So, okay. Any other questions? All right. Can I have someone make a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Okay. Second. Motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right. We are adjourned. Thank you.
You came to the easy meeting then.